Sorry.
Morning.
Morning.
Rory Lead, on behalf of Geico Indemnity. Can I have 2 minutes, Your Honor?
You may.
Thank you. Again, I apologize. Coughing this morning. Your Honor, make no mistake that the reason we're here is because the university wants to develop a third-party bad faith claim.
Well, help me understand this. How is a private consumer protection action a bad faith claim?
So
I thought they were two different causes of action.
So the courts have talked about that going all the way back to Tank versus State Farm, and most recently in the Panag, if I pronounce that right, case. And I'll direct Your Honor to the quote that I think addresses it best. So if the court remembers, in Panang, the credit collection companies were making the argument, similar to me, that there couldn't be a CPA claim. Okay, and here's what the court said. The court said, we reject this characterization because this case does not involve a contest over liability or damages resulting from an automobile accident. Rather, it involves allegedly deceptive methods used by a collection agency to recover money. So the consistent theme from Tank to all the Court of Appeals cases to Panag has been, we're not going to allow there to be a third-party bad faith claim because you already have two tort adversaries who are disputing liability and damages. And there is going to be antagonism, rightfully so, because they're adversaries. So what the university is trying to say is that, well, there is some exception, but there isn't. And the Panag case specifically talked about that. In the context, it's a very narrow context, but in the context of two tort adversaries disputing liability and damages, we are not going to allow there to be a CPA claim, essentially a bad faith claim against the insurance company. And here's why it's important and why it makes sense from a public policy standpoint. Insurance companies already have a quasi-fiduciary duty to their own insureds, in this case, Mr. Murphy. They have an obligation to protect Mr. Murphy and their insureds. If you create some other duty or obligation to this third party, you have conflicting duties, which you can't have, and is against public policy and would not further the goals that Washington has always strived for of insurance parties, insurance companies protecting their customers. There is not a single case that has been cited to you by the university to support their position. And there, as I said, going back 30 years, case after case after case, that the state of Washington is not going to allow. Now, as an aside, the legislature can do what they're going to do. But that being said, the court system has consistently said we're not going to allow this, because now what you're doing is you would be creating an entire secondary satellite of litigation. Not only are we going to have the litigation between the two tort adversaries, anytime my feelings are hurt because they don't pay me the money I want, I'm going to sue their insurance company too. And now you exponentially increase the amount of litigation for no good public policy reason. And the reason why this is the issue I've led with is that if this court agrees with me, you don't have to go any further. That if the CPA claim is dismissed as a matter of law, there is no recovery under the CPA. There's no recovery for attorney's fees. And we don't have to address any other issue.
On the fee issue below, once the court allowed the consumer protection action, there was a verdict. Did the did GEICO argue to segregate fees between pre-amendment, post-amendment, or any form of segregation?
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding is that they did, and that was rejected by the court. We believe improperly, and I think we have briefed that. We believe that we did preserve that issue, and that I think the judge actually addressed it in a number of issues about why the judge thought it was related, and of course we disagree. If the court wants to address the substance of the CPA claim, the court could say we don't need to find in this case whether or not there is or is not a third-party bad faith. We are just going to address it on the merits. I think that the merits fail completely because of the two stated issues of the unfair act or practice. The first one is the transposition of the numbers. I think, quite honestly, I think the university has kind of given up on that being an unfair act or practice. At best, it's a transcription error that was corrected within days, and the parties ultimately agreed to the 50-50 at that time. So I don't even think they give that much merit. So what comes back to this court's analysis is the breaching of the 50-50. there is no evidence of any kind that would support that GEICO's disagreement to follow the 50-50 was in any way deceptive or unfair. In fact, the very reason that GEICO said we're no longer going to abide by that 50-50 is because your driver, your officer, University of Washington, was at fault, not our insured.
Does the appellant take the position that there's not a breach of contract?
For the purposes of today, Your Honor, I concede that we did not appeal the breach of contract findings. I think that consistently we have argued that there wasn't a contract, but I don't think that that matters, Your Honor, because what has to happen for a Consumer Protection Act is there must be something more than a breach of contract. Washington law has been consistent on that, and the university concedes that in their brief. Otherwise, every time parties breached a contract, there would be a CPA claim. So what you have to have is some additional evidence of nefariousness, some deceptive reason going on. And here's why their claim completely fails. The University of Washington knew in 2011 when they got that full police report that their own driver was 100% at fault for the accident. They concealed that. They concealed the very issue that gave them fault, and that's why they wanted to keep that 50-50 so hard, because their own driver was at fault. GEICO told the university, we no longer are going to abide by this because we think your driver is at fault. They knew their own driver was at fault. How can GEICO taking that position be in any way unfair or deceptive? There's just no evidence to support that. If there was through some discovery that GEICO said, you know what, we're University of Oregon Duck fans, we just don't like the Huskies, so we're going to change our position. Okay, that might be unfair. That might not count as a legitimate reason, but there's no evidence of that here. It was very clearly communicated to them why they were no longer going to abide by it, and their own evidence indicated that their person was
real quickly here before we run out of time, what specific discovery was GEICO or not able to do as a result of the amendment of the complaint?
Sure. I think that the biggest scope would have been, what exactly are you claiming? As you've seen the briefs, it was sort of in and out during trial about what were you really claiming was the unfair act or practice, and really what is the proximate caused damage? That's the key, and that's another one of the issues up on appeal, is if you've got a brand new cause of action with brand new elements, and most importantly, Your Honor, before that CPA claim, there was not going to be a claim for attorney's fees. There was not going to be a trebling of damages. So by allowing that CPA claim in without any discovery of damages, the exposure to GEICO became much, much, much bigger without notice. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Howard Goodfriend representing the University of Washington. Let me address first this issue about this being a third-party bad faith claim. It is not. It is unchallenged now and undisputed now that GEICO repudiated an agreement to a 50-50 split of liability with the university in resolving these several personal injury claims and property damage claims arising from a collision between GEICO's insured Mr. Murphy and a UW Police Department vehicle. Now, GEICO stipulated that its actions occurred in trade and commerce. It stipulated that its actions affected the public interest. And the trial court refused to allow the university to proceed under a per se basis. It's not a per se claim. The insurance commissioner's regulations and duties to insureds have nothing to do with this case. GEICO's position is that because only an insured has standing to bring a per se CPA claim under the insurance commissioner's regulations, insurers are thereby granted immunity to commit unfair, deceptive acts against anyone else. And that is a position that has been rejected time and again by the Supreme Court in terms of CPA standing. Penang involved an insurance company itself, and the court said any person under RCW 19.86.090 means what it says. The court did the same thing in Fison's, and in Tank and Transamerica, the court specifically left open whether even a third-party claimant, which the university is not, has standing to bring a non-per se CPA action.
What's the position of respondent on the idea that UW was concealing information about the driver being at fault, I mean the officer being at fault?
Well, two things. One is that the trial court made evidentiary rulings in motions in limine before trial to which no assignment error has been made, no argument has been made on appeal, that this case was not about liability, but about a breach and a repudiation of this 50-50 agreement. That is not before the court. But even if it were, if you look at what the trial court said when she, in the middle of trial, reviewed these police reports, because Skyco tried time and time again to get them in, she said the idea that the university withheld information was a, quote, colossal strategy game by Geico, raised at the 11th hour, all of which may affect liability underlying case, but has absolutely no effect on any issue between these parties. Geico, I mean, what Geico did here was it deceived not just the university, but also third-party claimants. I'm talking now about why this was an unfair and deceptive act or practice that had the capacity to deceive a substantial portion of the public. Exhibits 265, 269, and 285 are the letters that Geico sent out confirming this 50-50 agreement, not just to the university, but to the other parties. The university's risk manager said they had never seen an insurer renege on such an agreement in 30 years. Geico took the position before the jury that it was never bound by an agreement to apportion liability. And, quote, it has never been to an agreement that was not fluid. That was its position, that there was no such thing as a binding agreement between two insureds with respect to liability. This undermined the public policy in settling litigation. It burdened the costs, the courts, which had to stay these underlying actions because there was a dispute about whether liability was conceded. It increased the cost of defending these claims to the university. It increased the cost of prosecuting these claims to the litigants. And it increased the cost of insurance to everyone, needlessly. So,
turning to the damages
issue,
what is the basis for the $300,000 reward in your view?
Well, first of all, let's dispose of the notion that there was no evidence of damages at all, because we know injury to property or business to any extent satisfies the CPA. So the fact that damages based on the contract award is undisputed. This was, and there's evidence before the jury, that it was a serious accident, major claims, a total of three property claims, four personal injury claims, only one of which had been settled. And if you look at RP 308 and the transcript on November 5th at page 94, it's a big claim affecting the reserves. That was the testimony. And one of the reasons Geico refused to honor this agreement was because of their concern that the claims were so substantial that it would blow through their $300,000 limits. And that's why they didn't want to honor it, because it could result in payments in excess of their policy limits. That's at page 401, Mr. Munn. So three of these PI claims were still pending before the court. Two had filed suit. And notably, there was Geico didn't propose and the court gave no instruction about how to evaluate the amount of damages under the CPA. There was a contract instruction, but there was no CPA damages instruction. The jury was left to its own discretion to put in a number, and it did so based upon the evidence before it and the inferences it drew from that evidence that this was going to be well in excess of a $300,000 claim. That's why they were here, and that's the evidence that supports the damages.
Let me ask you a couple questions.
Go ahead.
Attorney's fees. So when you started out, you had a claim for $9,750. So it was a breach of contract claim.
Correct.
That amount would fit under 484.250.
That's correct.
When you amended to add the Consumer Protection Act claim, that that pleading increased the amount at issue. We know that because you accepted entry of a judgment for almost $310,000. Didn't you lose the ability to get an award of fees under the statute dealing with claims for less than $10,000 when either you amended the complaint to add the CPA or you accepted entry of a judgment for $310,000?
Yes, I think we probably did. But if this court were to adopt this argument and reverse the CPA claim as a matter of law, you'd be back where you were under 250.
Well, then we're back to my second question. It's just the basis. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about the court's basis for the fees. Then the second question is that it was stated that that there was litigation in the trial court about segregating the CPA award of fees pre-amendment and post-amendment. I think that's what I understood the discussion
was. Well, I think the argument – I'm sorry.
My question is, do you agree that that's in the record?
I don't think that level of specificity is in the record at all. I think the argument was that, hey, this was a contract claim, it's also a CPA claim. They're two different claims. You can't award all the fees. You have to segregate the time spent on the Consumer Protection Act claim from the time spent on the contract claim. And what the trial court found, and again, there's no challenge to these findings, was that it was impossible to segregate the time spent on the contract claim and the CPA claim. And this is conclusion of law 8 on CP 6978. The exact same evidence presented on the contract claim was what was required to prove the unfair and deceptive conduct under the CPA.
So the record contains the answer we would get were we to, well, I understand what
it
you're
does. And to the extent that the court did segregate fees, it accepted counsel's position in their fee application that no time related post-trial to the equitable claims that it also entered findings on post-trial were at issue, and there was no fee award for that. There were substantial findings here that the trial court, in fact, reviewed and added some language in terms of what she relied on and made some corrections. GEICO zealously defended this case to the max before it was a CPA claim.
And I suppose that's the part that troubles me a little bit. Up until 2 weeks or 3 weeks before trial, 2 weeks before trial, 15 days, it wasn't a CPA claim. How is all of that work that's done attributable to a CPA claim when it wasn't even a CPA claim?
Because in order to prove liability under the CPA, that's what they had to show. The same evidence and contentions regarding a breach and a repudiation of this agreement to share a liability 50-50 was the basis of the CPA.
And as far as the multiplier goes, I mean, how does it was a routine breach of contract claim all the way up until the CPA claim was filed. What extraordinary risk was there to the university in defending against that claim?
Well, the university had spent hundreds of hours, a lot of it because in contested discovery motions on which it prevailed, to get to the evidence that established the basis of the CPA claim, which was why GEICO stipulated, I think, the public interest. Because only after a deposition was compelled where the adjuster admitted that GEICO not only did this here, but has reneged on agreements in other cases, the same adjuster, that was the basis of the amendment. And that was based on evidence that GEICO withheld, that the university had to diligently pursue, and once it came to light, that became the capacity to deceive a substantial portion of the public and the public interest elements of the CPA. And those were maybe, you know, uncovered in a breach of contract discovery dispute, but they were essential to the CPA claim. And the trial court found that all that time should be awarded.
Well, maybe the trial court should have found the time that related to discovering that stuff before the CPA claim was filed might have been part of it, but there's a long history of that case before that as well, and the trial court included that too.
Because GEICO reneged on an agreement that affected not just the university, but all these other people, the exact same theory that was being pursued in the breach of contract claim. Precisely the same evidence.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
First, there is no question. This is absolutely a third-party bad faith claim. There's only two parties with an insurance company. Either you're a first-party insured, who you bought the policy from the insurance company, or you're not a first party, and therefore you're a third party. This is their attempt to create third-party bad faith law in the state of Washington that has been completely rejected time and time again. The university cannot cite to this court a single case that says two tort adversaries that are disputing liability and damages that from that can arise a CPA claim. 30 years of case law, and they don't cite a single reason to this court to change that. Number two, the sole reason that there was so much of a burden on the UW is because they concealed the fact that they knew their driver was 100% at fault. had they just stepped up and done the right thing and admitted that their own investigation concluded their driver was 100% at fault and that their initial discussion about liability was wrong, they wouldn't have been in the position they were in. They concealed information to save themselves money. That's what this case is about. And then they tried to create a bad faith case out of it. But part of this discussion, I think, as well, has shown the court the prejudice that GEICO faced with 2 weeks before trial. And as this court knows, being judges and trying cases, you are intimately involved in trial preparation and understanding what your themes and case is going to be about. And then all of a sudden, a brand new claim with entirely different damages, entirely different proof, and comes into play. GEICO was prejudiced, and all of this could have been avoided had the court either denied it or allowed GEICO the opportunity to conduct discovery. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.